It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, rates of suicide are often higher in rural areas than in cities, according to the CDC. We'll hear from a Wisconsin farmer who understands the struggle of mental health in rural America from personal experience. First, Hurricane Florence is hitting the Carolinas after being downgraded to a Category 1 storm today. The storm has brought high winds and torrential rain to the southeastern United States. There are already reports of people needing to be rescued, severe damage to homes, widespread power outages, massive flooding, and sadly, deaths have been reported. Our next guest is here to talk about the storm and what we might expect during the rest of hurricane season. Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Waukesha County. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, tell us the latest about Hurricane Florence.
Well, right now the center of Hurricane Florence is actually very close to the coast of the border of North and South Carolina. It's about 40 miles to the west-southwest of Wilmington, North Carolina. It's just moving slowly to the west, about 6 miles per hour. The center of it did make landfall this morning right near Wrightsville Beach, which is right near Wilmington, North Carolina, as only a Category 1 hurricane, but it certainly has a lot of water with it, both rainfall and storm surge flooding, and that just continues in an inexorably slow crawl.
Yeah, we've seen the storm downgraded from Category 4 down to 3, 2, and as you say, 1. That doesn't mean it's not going to be destructive, though. What is the category part of this measure?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that. The perception is that this storm is downgraded, it's weakened, it's not a big threat. But what the category system is, it's called the Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Wind Scale. And basically, it only categorizes a hurricane based on its winds. So its winds may be down to, right now, 75 miles per hour, and it did only make landfall as a Category 1 hurricane. But again, that's only the wind potential of a hurricane. There are two other main impacts of a hurricane in this particular case that have been very dangerous and have already been destructive: the storm surge flooding and then the rainfall flooding. And particularly with the rainfall flooding, that has almost nothing to do with how strong the winds are. That has everything to do with how slow the system moves. So it's almost similar to an East Coast version of Harvey from last year, because the system is moving so slowly, it's dumping just incredible amounts of rain, and therefore it's been very destructive and will continue to be destructive for the next few days.
Yeah, for the people who are going to get hit worst by that slow-moving rainfall, what kind of total rainfall are we worried about here?
Well, Rob, I guess the best way I can put this in perspective, so it's so far this year, through September 13th, it's been the wettest single year to date in Madison, largely due to the flooding rain that Dane County picked up and, of course, western Wisconsin last month. So if you melted all the snow Madison has picked up this year and added that to the rain they picked up, that would go to about 39 inches for the year. So consider that parts of eastern North Carolina could pick up 39 or 40 inches of rain in just 2 or 3 days. Can you imagine that amount of rain? That's the big problem. Not only are they getting that rain, but then there's also this storm surge flooding that occurred, of course, with the landfall. So you're pushing all this ocean water toward the coast, and that also pushes into all these bays and rivers and inlets in eastern North Carolina. So all this rain can't go anywhere because all the rivers are backed up from ocean water being pushed ashore. I mean, it really is a two-pronged hydrological mess in eastern North Carolina. And again, imagine a year's worth of Madison rainfall being dumped in 2 to 3 days. That's what North Carolina is dealing with.
Do you worry that when people hear a storm being downgraded, maybe people in an affected area, that they say, oh, good, it's not as bad as they thought, I can stay put?
Yeah, we are very worried about that. Pretty much the entire meteorological community has been trying to communicate that, don't pay too much attention to the winds. Of course, the winds are a threat. Structural damage from winds is a threat. But to be honest, we've been calling this a Category 5 flood risk. So if we had a separate category just for flooding, this would be the top end of it. And it's important to note that a study by the National Hurricane Center several years ago, basically 3 out of every 4 deaths from tropical storms and hurricanes in the U.S. are from water, not from wind, with storm surge killing the most, and then rainfall flooding kind of a secondary killer in the U.S. So A very small percentage of people are killed by wind in hurricanes. It's mostly due to storm surge and rainfall flooding.
Now, Florence, we're going to be watching that over the weekend. Of course, we're also seeing other storms, Joyce, Helen, Isaac, all churning at the Atlantic. Helene, not Helen. What are you watching for with those and the rest of hurricane season in our last minute or so?
Well, Rob, I'll start with some good news. Both Joyce and Helene are tropical storms right now, and they're right in the middle of the Central Atlantic, and they're no threat to the U.S. So, you know, those are just curiosities out there. If you're involved in shipping lanes or shipping interests, you might have curiosity there. But, again, those aren't a concern for us. We do have a tropical depression, Isaac, in the eastern Caribbean Sea. It's really struggling right now, and we still have to keep a watch on that, just do our diligence in the heart of hurricane season. In the Gulf next week, but for now it looks like it may dissipate in 2 or 3 days in the western Caribbean Sea, but we'll still keep an eye on that. There was another disturbance right near the Texas coast that looks like it's going to push into Texas before it has a chance to develop. Could produce some heavy rain there, but so our fingers are crossed that once we get done with Florence and its remnant heavy rain, which will also, by the way, soak the Appalachians early next week, that will finally calm down at least for a period of time. But, of course, we still have a couple of months left of the hurricane season, so we could still have another one to track.
We'll keep watching for that. Thanks to Jonathan Erdman, senior meteorologist at weather.com. He's based in Waukesha County. It's no secret that being a farmer can be a tough job. Jeff Ditzenberger knows this firsthand. He's a corn and soy farmer in Monroe. He's struggled for decades with mental health problems and says that the suck-it-up attitude that many rural residents embrace isn't always helpful. In 2015, he started a support group called TUGS, or Talking, Understanding, Growth, and Support, and has been an advocate for mental health for farmers and other rural residents. We talked to Jeff last week. Jeff, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Not a problem. I appreciate it. Thanks for asking me.
Well, before we get into your story and the story of TUGS, talk about some of the struggles and stresses that farmers face day-to-day that people who aren't in the business might not even think of.
Right now, commodity prices, any commodity, whether it's milk, soybeans, corn, oats, wheat, whatever, all the different products that we're producing to put on America's tables are at an all-time low. They're at a 10-year low. As a matter of fact, the farm that I used to dairy with, they're getting less for their milk now than my dad was getting before he got out back in the early 90s. So that's one of the biggest struggles. I've talked to quite a few farmers that are starting to bite into their equity, bite into their savings accounts, just to make ends meet. And that's a huge struggle right off the bat. I mean, you know, you don't like to think that money makes people happy, and it doesn't necessarily, but, you know, you can't really call your bill collectors and say, hey, I don't have it this month. You got to figure out a way to make it work.
And even when things are going well this month, there's that, you know, that threat, I guess, of one thing going wrong, sick animals, broken equipment, whatever, that tips you over the edge.
Yeah, you know, it used to be that they used to say that, you know, farming was a job that anybody can do, and I would challenge that every day. You need to be a money manager, you need to be a banker, you need to be an equipment appraiser, you need to be an agronomist, you need to know the land, you need to be a family person if you've got, you know, kids, wife, or husband, depending on, and, you know, that's one of the things too. There's a lot of females that are doing this job now as a primary farm shareholder. Or, you know, the husband's doing a job in town where they're staying home and taking care of the animals and stuff like that. And it's a pretty tough balance. Weather, you know, you can't control the weather at all. And I tell people in this business and in life in general, you know, the only thing you can truly control is your attitude. And that's one of the things that we're starting to see kind of dwindle. Farmers are very proud people. But pride doesn't pay the bills.
Let's talk about your story a little bit. 25 years ago, that day to day, it sounds like it got to be too much for you.
It was pretty bad. My marriage was falling apart, and I was actually working on a farm and working in town at the time. Depression was starting to get to me. I had just gotten back from stint in the Gulf, and I didn't see any combat, but there was still a lot of tensions that went on. And then even coming back to the States, there were people that, you know, didn't think that we should be there, and we dealt with a lot of that type of stuff. So I was kind of dealing with that too. Luckily for me, I never got involved with the narcotic types of the drugs, but alcohol is pretty easily accessible, to the point where I was putting that in my coffee in the morning. I was having beer or mixed drinks at lunch. I'd come home and do chores and go finish a 12-pack of something or a bottle of something or whatever, and just, you know, kind of muddling through life. And I remember, one of the things I remember vividly was reaching out to people and saying, you know, hey, I'm not feeling right. I don't feel like my normal self. I'm not happy, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that was the, you know, I'll suck it up, you know, especially from a male standpoint. I mean, males, generally speaking, the men in society, we're not supposed to talk about our feelings. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to get rid of, too. Not only the stigma of mental health, but the fact that men are just as human as anybody else. And if you need to talk to somebody, by God, talk to somebody.
And you hit a point where you were, maybe you came out of it, not sure what just happened, maybe ready to take your own life.
And I did. The other thing, there's a misconception out there about suicide where a lot of people think it's a rash decision. You know, I planned mine over probably three, four weeks or more. The part of it that's kind of ironic is that the way that I intended to do it, I was a firefighter at the time, and I lit an old abandoned house on fire. And that's how I was going to finish myself off, which a lot of times when I start some of my speeches about this, I'm like, if you're going to fail, try to set the building on fire and have your suicide note in your pocket, because it's probably not going to get out to people. I mean, that's just how messed up a person's mind can get. And later on, too, a lot of the people that, you know, that I'd reached out to, or even people that I didn't reach out to, were like, we had no idea, none whatsoever. And, you know, it's not, you advertise it as much as you can, but there's two challenges, and it's still 25 years later, this is still a challenge. There's two challenges with it. Is one, there's still a stigma with people that have mental health issues. I have PTSD. I am bipolar 2. I have anxiety, relationship anxiety, and a few other things. You know, if you see somebody sniffling, you'll, even if you don't know them, you might say, hey, you got a cold? Oh, yeah, I got a cold. Oh, this is what I did for that. If you see somebody kind of down in the dumps, a lot of times you don't take that, hey, are you okay today? You know, and the other thing, the other part of that is that if you ask that question, you know, and the common answer mostly is, oh, yeah, great, you know.
No problem.
How you doing? Oh, good, I'm good. You know, I don't think a lot of us are prepared to hear that, no, I'm not okay today.
I want to get into your group, your project here, Tugs. And mm-hmm. I love the name, because you're in the Navy.
Yes, sir.
And you're inspired by the tugboat. So you got the biggest, strongest boats on the ocean, and they need a little bump sometimes. And yep. That doesn't mean they're weak, right? I love that metaphor.
Gosh, it's almost like you're taking my thunder on that, like you're in my brain. But no, so I spoke out at Guys Night Out up here in Madison a couple years ago for the Madison Safe Communities. And I really didn't know what I was going to talk about. I mean, I had a speech all written, and myself and a buddy of mine and my uncle and another friend got in the vehicle, and we're driving up here, and I ripped the paper up and I threw it in the McDonald's bag because we had grabbed a little bite to eat on the way up here. You know, they're like, isn't that your speech? And I'm like, yeah. And so I'm, you know, and I don't normally write speeches. I do a lot of stuff off the cuff. And all of a sudden, it's time for me to talk. And I get up there, and I'm still not sure. So I introduce myself, and I kind of talk about a little bit of my history, and I mention the Navy, and that's when it hit me. We were on the second largest displacement ship in the military. So you have the aircraft carriers, and then there's us. Now, with us, when you come into port, or if you have to go through docks, or if you have to go through, like, a treacherous, you know, narrow waterway or whatever, you call a tugboat. And this little tugboat comes on over, and you can't see them usually, but you know they're there. And, you know, they get you through this treacherous water, or they put you back home, or put you into port or whatever. And, you know, and I said, and I think that's what all of us need is a tug, someone that we can reach out to when times are tough. One of the biggest challenges in the mental health industry right now is that there's not a lot of therapists out there, and if you call, it takes forever to get in. Not everybody needs that right now, though. Sometimes you just need somebody to talk to. And the acronym TUGS is talking, understanding, growing, and supporting. And so in 2015, I did my articles of incorporation, got it all incorporated and stuff, put the board together. We kind of did some smaller group venues. And one of my goals is that hopefully I can help other communities set up kind of the same thing. When you come into our meetings, it's kind of like AA or NA. That's what I kind of modeled it around a little bit from some friends that I had talked to. You basically come in. You don't have to say your name. You can sit in the back corner. and listen, and maybe somebody's up at the podium that talks about what happened to them, and you can relate to them, and you go up and talk to them afterwards, and you exchange phone numbers or emails or something, and then on those bad days, that's the person you reach out to.
I got to ask, though, at the first meeting, you got a group of guys, mm-hmm. farmers,
mm-hmm.
people who don't want to talk mm-hmm. about this stuff, people who don't want to hear this stuff. What happened at the first meeting?
It's quiet. Anytime you get into a group setting, you know, there's that risk because you have so many different personalities and so many different problems and stuff. And basically, so what I ended up doing is kind of explaining what the goal was, because it was kind of a pilot meeting anyways. I wanted to kind of get the mood and the feel and stuff. And I told him, I said, you know, this isn't group therapy. This is a support group. There's you know, two different, you know, I've got people on staff and on the board that are versed in that and that are psychologists, psychiatrists that you know, can be referred to or whatever. But that's not what I just, you know, so threw out the question, you know, how's everybody doing?
Yeah, we're fine.
Yep. Yep.
Right.
So, you know, and so then I told my story. And I think one of the easiest things to do is just get the conversation started. You know, and people ask me, you know, do you get tired of telling your story over and over again? And I don't, you know, because there's always certain little things, certain different things like that. I remember when Vice News came out from HBO and interviewed me, we actually went back to the site. And that was the first time in 25 years. And wow. It really took me out of my comfort zone. But it closed the chapter, you know. And so for me, you know, I keep thinking that the more I tell my story, hopefully it'll reach other people. Even if they don't tell their story, if it just makes them feel a little bit better, or even if you hear somebody and you take that adage of, geez, maybe my life isn't quite as bad as I thought it was, you know, that's my goal. Getting people to talk, obviously, is extremely important to me, but right now, getting people just to know that it's okay to not be okay, that's my bigger message right now.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from your fellow farmers who have joined in and maybe taken the plunge and told part of their story?
The response has been pretty overwhelming, especially since the most recent interviews with Channel 3000 and obviously HBO. I mean, I've even had people contact me from all over the United States now. And I want to make it clear, I'm not a therapist. I have no mental health training. I know a lot of stuff, but you know, it's a personal experience type thing. It's really surprising how people are reaching out. The other thing that people reach out and do, though, too, which is kind of cool, is that, you know, hey, I can relate to this, you know, or I just talked to my dad and he just said that he saw your interview too. And, you know, and now we're talking about things that has been tension between us and stuff like that. So that's what the whole idea originally was with Tugs, is just to start to get these conversations started. Because, like, when I was going through my tough time that led up to my suicide attempt, I didn't want to talk to my family about it because I already felt like I was a burden already anyways. And for those of you that are out there that are listening to this, that are in that mode, you're not a burden to anybody. Reach out to someone, a friend, you know, somebody who you know is going to be, who's going to be neutral. And my Tug, that I have my own personal Tug, you know, we're open and honest with each other. If he thinks I'm being a Sally, he lets me know I'm being a Sally. If he thinks that I, you know, maybe need to call a therapist, I call a therapist. But at least I have someone who's completely unbiased, and that's what the idea behind it was. Someone unbiased but yet still cares enough to listen to you that, you know, it gets you through that rough patch.
Now, you had a message there for people who might be going through that rough patch. How about the people around them? What should people watch for, listen for? How can they react when they get that sense, like you were saying earlier, you're not feeling like yourself, things aren't quite right now?
You know, a couple years ago, I saw somebody who had a scar on their head, and I was in a grocery store, and I didn't know this person, and somebody came up to him, and they said, hey, did you just have surgery? That's what you need to do. If you see somebody who's having that, who doesn't look, especially if it's someone you know and it's not their normal demeanor and stuff, don't be afraid to ask, but also don't be afraid to maybe hear some stuff you're not going to want to hear. And if you can't handle that, tell them, hey, I'm not able to help you with this. I don't understand entirely what you're going through, but I understand you're having a tough time. Let's see if we can't get you some help. What would make you comfortable? Do we need to talk to a therapist? I mean, I've called 911 before with friends that have had other friends on the phone or on Messenger or whatever the case may be, you know, but don't take away from those people. Don't try to devalue or invalidate, is that a word, what they're going through, because it's real. There's a lot of this going on out there right now.
But we're Wisconsin nice, Jeff, and we don't want to pry. How can we get over that?
you need to ask the question. Put yourself in that person's shoes. I mean, that's, to me, that's what I always go through real quick. When we were going down to where my suicide attempt had happened, one of my things that I enjoy to do is ride motorcycles. So I took my motorcycle down there, took a wrong turn on purpose because I started to get shaky. And last thing I knew, I'm looking down at my speedometer. I hope there's no cop friends of mine out there listening to this, but I'm doing like 80 miles an hour down the road because I wanted to get away from there. And all of a sudden it hit me. I'm like, this is not about you. This is about everybody who felt like you. This is the time to make that difference and to tell people that, you know, just because you're feeling bad doesn't mean that you can't talk to people about it. So I, you know, turned around, told the crew that, hey, I took a wrong turn, you know, whatever, went down there and faced it. And that's, if we are Wisconsin nice and we are a proud state, but we take care of our own. You know, we've got a great football team. That football team takes care of themselves. You know, they're taking care of each other all the time. The Packers, you know, that's a team aspect and stuff, and they're keeping each other up. The challenge that it is, especially with the farming community, which was, you know, and I don't focus strictly on the farming community, but that's community I know really, really well. But with the farming community, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in their lives. If you live next to a farmer, most of them have an open-door policy. Bake them some cookies and take them over and say, hey, I hear you're having some struggle, or I hear times are tough, or hey, you know what, I think your farm's beautiful and you do a great job, and thanks for putting food on my table and, you know, being conscientious about what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera. You have to have that conversation. We need to get over that stigma that mental health is a bad thing, because we all have it.
Jeff, thanks a lot for coming up, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Not a problem. Thank you.
That was Jeff Ditzenberger, corn and soy farmer in Monroe. In 2015, he started a support group called TUGS, or Talking, Understanding, Growth, and Support. He's been an advocate for mental health for farmers and other rural residents. There can be two big obstacles to cooking, especially if you want to make a big multi-course meal for friends or family. One, it can be kind of intimidating trying to get a variety of dishes ready all at the same time. And two, what do you do with the leftovers? On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest tackles both of those problems in a new cookbook. Julia Tertian is a cookbook author and recipe developer. Her new book is Now and Again: Go-To Recipes, Inspired Menus, and Endless Ideas for Reinventing Leftovers. Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we've got this kind of two-pronged approach here that I love in the book. One is you pulled together these menus, multi-part menus for when we want to have that sort of occasion dinner. Talk us through your approach here so it doesn't seem so scary.
Sure. Yeah, the menus are, you know, they range from, you know, a weeknight dinner just for two at home to big holiday meals. And my purpose in presenting the book through menus is really to tell stories. You know, menus tell whole stories of meals, and they're how I've, you know, remembered my favorite times with family and friends. And the whole point of cooking at home to me is to gather people together, to bring people together, to build community, to sustain community. So it just seemed right to share all my favorite recipes in the form of menus.
Well, and on a practical level, and maybe I'm speaking more for myself than anybody else, what intimidates me is if I'm trying to make four different things, I'm worried that one will be late, one I'll have made on time, but it's cooling off and it's not good anymore. You've got a real time frame on how we pull together things where you allow us to maybe start planning even a month in advance.
Yeah. So, yeah, the sort of like emotional kind of temperature of the book is about gathering and everything, but it's also an incredibly practical book. So all the menus keep the kind of logistics in mind. And, you know, I'm a home cook who writes for other home cooks, so I think about all the same things everyone else does. You know, I don't want to be in the kitchen forever. I don't want to dirty all the dishes I own. I don't want to have to run out to the grocery store for an extra ingredient, you know, and so on. So every single menu is presented with a timetable. So if you want to start ahead, even if you want to start on some of them, as you said, a month ahead and put something in the freezer, you know, I give you all the information to break it down so that you can just be really calm in the kitchen, really excited to be there, feel really just relaxed and, yeah, not intimidated, not stressed out, just happy to be there and happy to, you know, have someone over.
We'll dig into some of the details of the recipes, but we've got, you know, so we've got the emotion and the gathering, we've got the practical side of preparing it, and then we've got leftovers, and then for each of these meals, you take pretty much every component and say, here's what you do with them for leftovers. Why was that an important part of the process for you?
So that's actually where the book started. I was going to write a book that was just about reinventing leftovers because I love to do that. I think it's really fun. And I also, it's also, again, really practical. I eat all of my meals at home. My wife and I live in a very rural area, so we don't really go out to restaurants or anything. So I'm always making more than we can eat, just so there's something cooked in the fridge and ready to go. But I don't like eating the same thing every day, so I always turn it into something new. And I was having so much fun doing that. So I thought that would be a great book. And then I felt like it wasn't giving the reader enough. You know, it's telling you the kind of after, but not also the before. So that's how the book sort of evolved and where the leftover ideas came from. And, yeah, they're really fun. It's all about kind of transformation. And, you know, I'm so thrilled to serve something to someone and, you know, if they were over the night before and have them have no idea that it's the same thing.
And the thing, here's one that kind of blew my mind. People who know me know I hate to let food go to waste. I've eaten way too much food to avoid throwing it away. I try these things for leftovers. The one food I will consistently throw away is scrambled eggs. Because what are you going to do with leftover scrambled eggs? And in your first menu, it's for a Bangladeshi breakfast. The meal, it includes scrambled eggs with cilantro. And then you have an idea of what to do with leftover scrambled eggs. Can you talk about that?
Sure, yeah. I think it's something a lot of people tend to have, like, a few, you know, leftover in the skillet, that kind of thing, especially if you're cooking for your family, and everyone throws them away, and, you know, some people feed them to their dogs, but otherwise, I had never seen anyone do anything with them, and I, you know, I was faced with a pan of scrambled eggs that was just too much to eat, and I thought, you know, these are cooked eggs. What else do I do with leftover cooked eggs? I always make egg salad, so I just bind the cooked eggs together with a little bit of mayonnaise, and the one I suggested in the book, the menu has this really delicious cilantro and coconut chutney that you can serve with the eggs. So if you have leftover of that, you can add it to the egg salad. A little bit of curry powder is delicious. So it's one with a little bit extra kind of flavor and dimension. But it could be as simple as, you know, scrambled eggs, mayonnaise, salt and pepper, call it a day.
We're talking about the new cookbook Now and Again, go-to recipes, inspired menus, and endless ideas for reinventing leftovers. Julia Tershin is the author, and she's with us right now. I want to dig into one of the menus. We've got a couple of the components that you shared at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're a few days late, but it's still a great meal, your Rosh Hashanah dinner. Can you tell us about that menu?
Sure, yeah. So it's Rosh Hashanah is the Jewish New Year, and in my family, as in many families, you make things that are quite sweet. You use a lot of honey, you know, things that lean towards sweetness. And the idea is to kind of ring in a sweet New Year. You know, there's all different New Year's traditions around the globe. So yeah, that's what we do. So I did a menu inspired by kind of meals I grew up eating. I have a big family, so I love, you know, making a meal that's easy to make for a lot of people, and it doesn't cost too much money. And keeping that idea of kind of fall ingredients and sweet ingredients in mind. The menu is delicious. I do something called Celebration Chicken, which is a recipe, if any of your listeners remember the Chicken Marbella recipe from the Silver Palette Cookbook that was, I feel like it was on every dinner table for decades. My Celebration Chicken is inspired by that. It's with sweet potatoes and dates. Again, really sweet and delicious. And you get kind of a side dish and a main dish in one. You mix everything in the roasting pan, all those ingredients with a bit of garlic and vinegar and oil. You don't even need to mix anything in a bowl. You just stick it in the oven. It's delicious. And since your oven is on, I did a baked saffron rice. And what I love about that is because it cooks in the oven, it cooks evenly. And I'm always burning rice on the bottom, or, you know, the middle of my pot isn't cooked, but the outside is overcooked. I always bump into these problems. So doing it in the oven makes it really nice and, you know, just even. And then the other final dish for the, you know, the main course is a beet salad that's super simple, cooked beets with a really lovely poppy seed dressing. So it's a nice menu. It's easy to make. It's really fun to eat. And for dessert, is an applesauce cake with a cream cheese and honey frosting. And, you know, I mentioned honey, and a really traditional thing for the Jewish New Year is to eat apples dipped in honey, which, you know, whatever your background, is a delicious snack. And so this cake is inspired by that really traditional combination. It's the easiest cake in the world. You just mix everything in one bowl. You don't have to cream sugar and butter, anything like that. You store-bought applesauce. The frosting is just cream cheese and honey whipped together. It could not be easier, but it's delicious. It's beautiful. It's one of my favorite things to make.
Got two of those recipes, the celebration chicken with sweet potatoes and dates, and that applesauce cake with cream cheese and honey frosting. Those are both online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Okay, now we've got leftovers of that stuff. You've got, with that saffron rice, you want us to stuff peppers there.
Yeah, I love stuffed peppers. It was something I ate growing up, and I don't see them very often, so I wanted to bring them back. So the idea there is just to mix leftover cooked rice. It could be any, you know, rice you have. It doesn't even have to be that recipe. And just mix it with some cheese. I really love rice mixed with feta cheese. And but, you know, use whatever you've got and put it into bell peppers that you've cut in half and kind of scoop them out to make almost, you know, like a little boat. And stick them in the oven. You could put a little water or chicken stock in the pan just to soften the peppers a bit. Kind of makes its own sauce, and it's a wonderful dish. Totally vegetarian. Eat those with like a salad. It's a great little dinner.
Do you come into cooking sometimes saying, I'm going to make a little extra of ingredient X, knowing that tomorrow I'm going to use some of the leftovers to make a completely different meal?
That's such a good question. You know, at this point I do, because I love it so much. I love, you know, turning things into something else, and certain things I think are so well suited for that. So, you know, if I'm ever making like chicken soup, I will always make extra broth because, you know, that can turn into anything. So, yeah, I definitely do that.
I'm the reverse. I'll make extra something like pulled chicken or something, knowing I'm going to make soup with it the next day, because soup is the ultimate leftover finisher for
great.
Me.
For sure.
We're talking to Julia Tershin. Her new book is Now and Again, Go-To Recipes, Inspired Menus, and Endless Ideas for Reinventing Leftovers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the best way to reuse leftovers and a plan to use them? Or do you have a favorite way, a tactic, a method to reuse a particular kind of leftovers? Do you like the leftovers better than the original meal in the first place? Do you have stories about your family and traditions of those leftover foods? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I remember cold meatloaf sandwiches the next day after meatloaf as a kid. We loved it. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a couple of Julia's recipes, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we continue our conversation about meal planning and the creative use of leftovers on this week's installment of Food Friday. Julia Tershin is a cookbook author and recipe developer. Her new book is Now and Again, Go-To Recipes, Inspired Menus, and Endless Ideas for Reinventing Leftovers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a set menu you like to make for particular gatherings of friends? Do you have leftover favorites? Maybe you look forward to them more than the original meal, or do you have questions? You always end up with leftover blank. What do I do with them? Julia might have some suggestions. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes there or at WPR.org/Food Friday. You have, Julia, in your book, some 7 things to do with a whole bunch of different things. These are useful lists. One I loved was with not-so-new produce. Can you give us a couple suggestions from that list?
Sure, yeah. That's at the back of the book. I think of it as like the bonus content. It's sort of 7 lists. Each has 7 ideas. And, yeah, so it's like almost 50 ideas for just really useful things in the kitchen. So the not-so-new produce, I think that's something we all encounter. And one of the ideas is I always have just extra celery. I don't know why, but I always have a ton of it. So a really
it's big. Like, you buy a lot of celery.
Yeah,
you can't
exactly
buy a bit of celery. Yeah.
Exactly. So a celery and Parmesan salad. You just slice them both really thinly and dress it with olive oil and lemon juice. It feels kind of like fancy, but it's, you know, it's made with just all that leftover celery that's kicking around. And another idea is to make a salsa verde, which is kind of like a loose pesto with your herb stems. So, you know, so often in recipes you see things like parsley and cilantro just, you know, calling for the leaves, and we don't think about the stems, and they have so much flavor, and if you chop them up really finely, you know, they're not tough to eat or anything, and they're delicious, and, you know, so you mix those with some garlic oil, a little bit of mustard, and vinegar, and it's wonderful. It's great on roast chicken or, you know, grilled pork chops, anything. It's really, really good.
It's Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Oneida County. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, when I was a kid, my mother and father would make a big meal on Sunday, and we would convert all of those meals into something else for the rest of the week. Now that I am a 60-plus-year-old fart, I now only take two meals. You know, I cook supper, and after supper is what I eat for the next day's lunch.
Mark, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. And that's on the practical side there, too, Julia, that idea of we're going to do the big extravaganza on Sunday and then use the components of that for quick meals throughout the week. Can you talk about that that strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of what Mark talked about. And I think, you know, if you invest a little time up front, you end up saving so much time. So if Sunday is a day when you have a bit of extra time, you know, make an extra roast chicken, make, you know, a big pot of rice, or cook a, you know, roast a tray of vegetables. You know, keep these things in your fridge and you can keep repurposing them, turn them into new meals. But you've already done the hard work. And it just, I think, you know, if taking that little bit of time up front, and then you can really serve yourself and your family the rest of the week, and you can just, you know, keep calm and make great meals. And it's a much more relaxed way to be in the kitchen.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Julia, I'll often have a game night at my house, and a lot of times, I'll be honest, the food ends up being delivery or maybe just some easy snacks on the counter. You have a card night tradition you talk about in your book. Can you tell us about that and the food you developed to go with it?
Sure, I'd love to talk about that because, it's a tradition I have with three of my best friends. We had started, the four of us, going out to restaurants together. We all lived in New York City at the same time, and that very quickly became really expensive, and we also couldn't spend as much time together as we wanted to because we were already, you know, always kind of hurried out once the check came. So we started cooking for each other, and to make those nights just kind of last a little bit longer and, you know, give us something to kind of do while we caught up, we started playing cards, and so we refer to our nights together as card nights. So that was sort of the story behind the menu. And the recipes in that menu are some of my favorite. The appetizer is just a skillet of shrimp that are cooked really quickly and easily with some garlic, and then finished with actually a splash of tequila and some fresh lime and a bit of fresh cilantro. And it's almost like a Mexican version of shrimp scampi. So instead of, you know, lemon, it's some lime. Instead of parsley, some cilantro. But they're so easy. They feel kind of festive and special to, you know, have a big skillet of shrimp, but they, you know, take 5 minutes and it's delicious. And then the main course for that menu are these roasted tomato and chicken enchiladas. And what I love about making those is that you have to make them ahead. So it makes it really easy when you have friends over, whether, you know, you're playing a game of cards or, you know, just anything to spend time together. You know, you're already done, and you just stick that in the oven to either finish cooking or warm up, you know, once you play your first round, whatever it might be, and then you can pull it out, and it's all done, and it's a really comforting dish. We all really enjoy it, so that's a really nice one. And I did a salad to go along with that, just to add a little something, you know, kind of healthy to the plate, and it's a kale salad with a toasted pumpkin seed dressing, and you puree those with some more lime juice and cilantro, those same ingredients you're using. Again, I don't want you to have to buy a million things at the grocery store to make one menu. You can use the same things for different recipes. It makes this really creamy, rich dressing, and, you know, you can do it on any kind of green, you know, romaine or... It just iceberg even would be delicious with that dressing. I chose the kale, just, you know, it's a little bit healthier, and it can also hold that dressing and sit for a while. It doesn't wilt or anything like that, so you can make the whole salad earlier in the afternoon and just pull it out for dinner, and you're good to go. And for dessert, since it feels to me a special occasion when I get together with these friends, it's my favorite toasted coconut cake, and it's so delicious. I love that cake.
Sounds fantastic. Becky from Watertown called in and wanted to know more about that saffron rice you talked about earlier. You use the leftovers to stuff peppers. You mentioned that you bake the rice. I do rice on the stovetop generally. How do we bake rice?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. So the rice, I start with a little bit of fat in the pan, and you could do olive oil or butter, a combination, whatever you want, whatever you have on hand, and cook a diced onion, and then I add the rice to the pan, and I do it with a little bit of saffron, but it's equally good without if you don't want that. You add a little bit of liquid, stock, water, again, whatever you have. It's a really, really flexible recipe. So you start it on the stove just to get that onion going, and I add a little bit of garlic too. But then once you add the rice and the boiling water or the stock, whatever liquid you're using, you just put the lid on there and stick it in an oven. I do it at 425 degrees, and I do that because that's what I roast the chicken at for the same menu, so, they can be in the oven together. And, it just sits in the oven for about, 25 minutes for white rice. It would be a little bit longer for brown rice, again, with the lid on. And then, you just pull the pot out of the oven, give the rice a little stir, with a fork just to fluff it up, and it's good to go. And it just, the oven just keeps the temperature so even, around the whole pot. So it's not just hot on the bottom the way it is on the stove. It's getting heat evenly from every side, and the rice just cooks perfectly. And you don't have to worry about, a burned bottom or, an underdone middle or anything like that.
And Julia, one of my favorite notes in the book, almost every dish you have, you give leftover recommendations for how to change it, except you have a note, you've got a baked pasta, and you say, don't change that. Why not?
I think cold pasta out of the fridge is delicious. especially baked pastas, like that one is a really, really simple and good. It's like a short pasta like penne or rigatoni, whatever you'd like, with like a really easy kind of turkey meat sauce and some cheese. So baked pasta like that or lasagna, to me, some of that cold out of the fridge is like a perfect food. I don't think you need to mess with that.
Right. I mean, when I've made lasagna, it's always better. I usually would reheat it, but it's always better somehow on day two than it is fresh out of the oven the first time.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And, I think a lot of foods that you enjoy as leftovers, think about Thanksgiving and how much we all look forward to eating that, that same meal for the next few days. I always try to keep that in mind when I'm preparing food in the first place, just remembering how good certain foods taste just as they are when they're left over, because that means you can make it ahead. So if you want to make something today and serve it tomorrow, because, that will make your day a little bit easier, by all means, not everything has to be made last minute.
All right, just 30 seconds left or so. Give us a quick pep talk on planning a fun multi-stage meal for friends or family.
Sure. My pep talk would be that you don't have to do everything. You don't have to be a hero by any means. You don't have to make everything from scratch. Don't be afraid to delegate. Don't be afraid to pick up part of your meal from the store. Having people over and making them something or just serving them food, even if you didn't cook it yourself, it's such an act of love to bring people together. So just, relax and just enjoy it. Enjoy the people you're with. And, don't stress about it.
That's a great place to leave it. Julia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julia Tershin is a cookbook author and recipe developer. Her latest book, we've been talking about it, it's called Now and Again, Go-To Recipes, Inspired Menus, and Endless Ideas for Reinventing Leftovers. She joined us on Food Friday to talk about the best ways to reuse those components of meals and make the case for cooking, having a good, fun meal, getting people together, multi-step meals. But are still easy too. Recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We love weird snack foods here on Central Time, and a popular brand is trying some new flavors and looking for your opinion. The makers of M&M's have three new flavors of peanut M&M's. They want people to try them and vote on them. The flavors are English Toffee Peanut, Mexican Jalapeno Peanut, and Thai Coconut Peanut. Chris Molina, producer here at the Ideas Network. You'll try just about any kind of snack flavor. What are you thinking so far?
And I will try these two, just in case you were wondering. My first thought was, what in the heck are they thinking? This is too bizarre. I don't know how this is going to pair with chocolate. But because it has that nut flavor, I actually think maybe it just might work.
Let's break them down one at a time. English toffee, peanut, that seems pretty safe to me.
Natural tie-in. The jalapeno one was the one I was kind of left scratching my head with, but I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt. And then the Thai chili, I could see that working. I could definitely see that working.
Like, a lot of Thai cooking has peanuts in it.
Right.
It doesn't have chocolate and food coloring shells around it, though.
That's true. And I think so many of these snack companies, they've already thrown a lot of stuff at us, and people like me usually can't be surprised anymore, and I was surprised today. So I think it's just going to get weirder from here on out.
Yeah, as I understand it, Chris, you work here basically to support your habit of trying weird new flavors of Oreos and Lay's and all
yeah,
that stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. And then I also exist to subject everyone else here to my weird whims and my weird foods.
Yeah,
so,
we'll never forget the day of the Swedish fish Oreos.
We shan't talk about that.
Let's not. Chris, thanks.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.